question number 1, 2, 3, 8, 5, rule 5.
Take it up from there, okay. Then. That
Bill Williamson, real 5.
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Williamson, you were in Perth.
Yes, and when the ship got to Perth there, that my friend Eric von Murray still stayed on the ship, and I thought I still had this. And I thought that if I left Australia, that I'd never obtain my idea of getting on one of the square riggers, so that I signed off in Perth off this German ship, and then I had a little bit of money, and then for one of the few times in my life, I paid my passage from Perth to Port Augusta, that's in South Australia. I hadn't quite enough money to take me all the way to Adelaide, but at least I travelled as a passenger on the train and not hoboing. And when I got to Port Augusta, I got a hitch on a boat,
Mr. Williamson,
I think.
Sorry, can I just,
oh yes.
Can I just adjust? Sorry, can I yes. just adjust this?
Oh yes.
Because of course, when you sit like that.
Then I made my way to one of the outlying ports of in the Gulf in South Australia that. I could look it up there and give you the actual port. It's the furthest one out, and I tried to get a job. The Pamir was in there load. They were all waiting, several ships, I think about a dozen at that time, waiting for cargoes for... all Ericsson ships, and they were waiting for cargoes of wheat for Europe, chiefly Britain. And although the skipper of the Pamir said he couldn't, he said he had an idea that a friend of his was shorthanded on the Archibald Russell in Wallaroo, and as they were going to... Wallaroo, that he just took me on the Pamir, which again was a four-masted bark. It was one of the P line from Germany, and the one thing that Ericsson always did, being an old sea captain himself, he thought it. He was superstitious and thought to change the name of a ship bode ill will for the ship, so that all the ships that he bought up, wherever he bought them from, were from Germany or Britain, France, whatever. He always kept their original names, such as the Archibald Russell and the Pamir. All the P ships were, they were the latest big square riggers. They were travelling in the nitrate trade just after the turn of the century, and they were the latest square riggers built at that time, and he'd bought those up. And the Pamir was quite an advance on the Archibald Russell. One thing, the wheel was amidships, and they had electric light and so on. From the donkey engine that supplied them. And anyway, to cut a long story short, I got to Wallaroo, and after a while I signed on the Archibald Russell. And by this time, I think most of the other ships had left for quite a while. I don't know how long I was in Wallaroo, but I think it must have been a couple of months, so that we were, the winter was fast approaching when I signed on the Archibald Russell, and we had a terrifically difficult journey. Well, it's not good at the best of times, but we were going round Cape Horn in winter, and I think it took us roughly about 180 days or something, because we made headwinds all the while. He was an obstinate, the skipper, the boat, quite a young skipper. I think he was only 26, and he was obstinate, and he kept on. I think he was the son-in-law too of Ericsson, the owner of the line. I think the mate, his chief mate certainly, and the second mate were telling him to turn and make it round South Africa to England, but he kept on, and we went more and more headwinds. Generally, they're westerlies all the way round Cape Horn, so that, but just at this time, I suppose we missed the, we had the westerlies in the roaring 40s getting down to Cape Horn, and then when we got close there, we met headwinds all the way, and we went further and further south, to try and make it, we ran in a lot of floating ice and icebergs and so on. I was used to a fairly hard life anyway, but even that was something terrific, that when you were climbing the yards, taking in the sails, your hands would get so numb that you felt you were going to fall, but the only way you could do it was by hammering your hands on the steel yards to get the circulation, even if it made them bleed, to get the circulation back in the thing.
What sort of gear were you wearing, Bill?
Pardon?
What sort of equipment? What were you wearing to keep warm?
Oh, well, I had plenty of sweaters and things, but you had... you had a sou'wester, and you had these oilskins on. But, of course, however much you tightened your belt around you, in the hurricane force winds, they would rip the oilskins up, and even your shirt almost over your head. And that is... to digress just a little bit, when you see even excellently done Hollywood movies of ship scenes and hurricanes and so on, or where you see Mutiny on the Bounty, you find these things, gale force winds and seas breaking over, but you never find the people tying their hats on or anything like that. Without your sou'wester tied tightly round your chin, and even then, in many cases, it's whipped off by the force of the wind with this. And then our forecastle was flooded out. We just had to sleep in the sail lockers. I think for days on end, week, 10 days or more, never any cooked food or anything. The cook on the boat, surprisingly enough, I never did ask how he got on it, was an English fellow, but he was... I don't know whether he'd been on these ships before, but he was used to the Scandinavian cooking. And eventually then...
what did you have to eat on the boat, Bill?
Oh, well, first of all, the standby was salt pork and salt beef. That is, they had great casks of brine in which they'd come out from Finland with this. They didn't buy it in Australia, of course, because that would have been too expensive. He's cutting to the... everything was brought from Finland. And this would be just soaked in brine, the salt pork and the salt beef. And then the cook would take it out and chop it up and make stews out of it. Of course, he made fresh bread daily when the conditions were favourable.
Any fruit or vegetables?
Pardon?
Any fruit or vegetables?
The one thing that I've never had it before, I don't know whether it was that they couldn't, they hadn't gotten around to doing. They had a lot of canned potatoes, and they were so terrible that even though I was hungry, I could hardly eat them, horrible tasting stuff. The other vegetables were mostly dried peas and things like that. But of course, no fresh vegetables at all.
Was there not a danger of scurvy?
Pardon?
Was there not a danger of scurvy if you had no...
Oh, yes. Well, that is one thing they did insist on, that most of the others took it as a medicine, but I liked it. And that was your ration of lime juice. Every day you had a big glass of neat lime juice, or half a glass, most of them had, but I would take up what they didn't. And that seemed to keep us going well.
Sorry, Bill, is this fresh lime from a lime itself, or is it a cordial sort of a thing from a concentrate? Do you know?
It's so long ago that I don't think the limes would have lasted long. No. It might have started that way with fresh limes, which they probably bought in Australia anyway, but... after that, then, but it wasn't a sort of cordial as you know it here. It was straight lime juice, I think out of a big can, probably a 5-gallon can or something like that. I know we just, and the officers were very strict on that. The old man on the ship insisted on checking that every man had a minimum amount of lime juice, so we kept quite well. We didn't wash so well, but we had, as I record, about you have these 5-gallon gasoline cans, and it's about sawn off about a third there, and it was a sort of a dish in the forecastle. And that water was put there. And as far as I know, we just dipped our hands in and rinsed it and before we had the meal. And everyone used the same thing for months on end. That, because the fresh water that we had had to be conserved just for drinking and cooking. And again, that was rationed out so much a day that... of course, it had plenty of rain and torrent, but it was often mixed up with salt and that thing. But I suppose, looking back on it now, the even young fellows would consider that horrific conditions. That and another thing is that I've seen one or two pictures of these sail training ships when they have these things and a mixture of them, whether they're Britain hasn't got very many, but the United States has, but above all the Soviet Union has the three largest windjammers in the world for sail training purposes, and You find there, even amongst the Russian cadets and sailors, that when they're wholly stoning the deck, perhaps I should explain what a holy stone is. You wouldn't know that. A holy stone is like a slab of, about a foot long, by about 9 inches wide, by about 6 inches deep, of a sort of stone, a soft sandstone, which you rub over the decks. Of course, the time to do that is when you can't do anything else, when you're in the bad weather. Of course, not in a terrific hurricane, but in a force 8 gale and so on. But now you see them doing it. I've seen with these TV crews, the way they do it now, they have a long pole like a broomstick and a little square metal thing that the holy stone fits in, and they rub it up and down with their standing up. Whereas there, whatever the weather was, short of a hurricane, you were kneeling down and doing it solidly, perhaps for the whole of your watch.
Which would be how long?
Pardon?
How long would your watch be?
They had funny watches, Scandinavian watches. They vary between 3 and 7 hours, unlike the British who worked, or the Americans, the British worked 8 hours on and 8 hours off, and the Americans worked 4 hours on and 8 hours off.
Why was it that the watches varied on these ships, the Ericsson line?
Pardon?
Why did they vary like this? How did they vary? How did they vary? When did they decide whether you were going to work 3 hours or 4 hours or 5 hours?
Oh, well, they're arranged in watches, you see, just as the you have the dog watches now. The watches now are on British and American ships from midnight to from 12 to 4, and then 4 to 8, and 8 to 12, and so on, until you come to the dog watches in the afternoon, when it's that's divided into two, so you don't get the same watch every day. That then is from 4 to 6 and 6 to 8, whereas this other one was alternated with, you might have, I think, 3 or 4 hours. I can't recollect now, but certainly between 5 and 7 hours. But of course, you'd have a break in between if you were doing the holy stoning. You'd go round to the galley and you'd have some hot coffee, and there was always plenty of that available. And then we ran, as I said, into these ice fields. They're right down there. And you had on the yards, they're completely covered in ice. And that is when I mentioned that you're banging your hands on the steel yards to get there. And you always had... and at all times, they always had a watch on the forecastle head there, but it wouldn't been any good if you were driving before a gale force wind. I remember one of the few Scandinavian words I remember is Isenfrut, so that ice ahead, but luckily we didn't ram into any icebergs. But we're often when you'd find ice around you. I don't know how far south we're, at one time I did know that how far south we went, but then eventually, after I think 3 months of that, we did manage to round the horn and made it up, only to be met with when we got into the better weather, the trade winds, and they seemed to desert us then, and we were becalmed long before we got to the doldrums. We got there and into the Sargasso Sea. I remember at that time that we saw all. We were often there, becalmed for days on end. That's where it took up such a long time. There's just one thing. And then I think I was just finishing my watch at, I think it was 8 o'clock in the morning. Somehow, I can't remember how these Scandinavian watches work, but I was just finishing my watch, and I mentioned to the fellow coming up on the forecastle head to relieve me that, and this was, we had a gentle breeze, about a 10-knot breeze there, and we were, the wind was on our quarter, and we were making quite good time. And then way over in the distance, way beyond the bowsprit, I could see this thing. It looked like a cloud at first, the sun glinting on it. Of course, the sun had only just come up. Could have been even earlier. Could have been at 7 o'clock. I'm not certain there. But the sun was glinting on this like a cloud. And then it got closer and closer. And of course, being away from Europe for so long, I sort of was out of touch with things. But I had heard about the Graf Zeppelin. I thought, no, it couldn't be the Graf Zeppelin. And I called down, and the mate came up, and then he went down and roused the roused the skipper, and then they got their powerful glasses on the thing, and they said it is Zeppelin, at Graf Zeppelin. I think that was the only one flying at that time. And then it gradually came closer and closer, and we all great excitement on the ship. And as it came closer, so it came lower and lower, and you see all these people. I've got a feeling, although it might have been mistaken, but they were so close, and certainly I was borrowing field glasses and looking through them too. I had a feeling a lot of them were in evening dress too, and it seemed such a strange thing, something you would never see on a Pan Am flight or something like that. But here it was just like a floating hotel that, or a liner in the skies that, and these people peering through the windows. Of course, it was in the tropics there, and waving to us, and then they were mate was signalling with a flash light, or it might have even we had no trans. That's another thing. There were no radios on our ship. On some of the Ericsson ships, like the Pamir, that had got a transmitter. It wouldn't transmit over great distances, but all the Archibald Russell had was a receiver, so that if you wanted to send out an SOS call, you couldn't do it anyway. So that, but they signal with flashlights and so on. They dropped two big packages, or three big packages, into the sea away from us. And I don't know how they kept it afloat with buoys of some sort, I suppose. Then a boat was lowered, and they went and caught it. And for about, at least an hour, the ship circled round, and the airship circled round and round. We hove to while we picked up the packages and then set our sails again. And even when we were sailing, the ship kept sailing round. You could see the people with all their cameras photographing us and so on. And I, when I first saw that, I had my camera. I don't know what it was now, and early type folding camera or some sort, I think. And I took a shot of the Graf Zeppelin through the rigging, which I was rather pleased with. And unfortunately, I can't find the negatives somewhere up in the loft right now. But I gave the big picture to my friend Barbara in Australia that I had a 2016 of the Graf Zeppelin taken through the rigging. And also, when I got to London, eventually I got a print made of the Graf Zeppelin taken through the rigging. And one of the cadets on the ship was either a friend or a relative of von Eckner, the commander of the Graf Zeppelin. And he sent this one, this picture off to von Eckner, because it took quite a while when the ship landed in the King George V docks, I think, in London. It took for quite a while before the berth was available. And then it all had to be, because they're sacks of grain, they're not unloaded automatically. They've all got to be taken out, it takes longer to unload them. And anyway, whether that was there or whether he sent it, I can't remember, but he sent this picture of the Archibald Russell from the Graf Zeppelin. I have a small picture of it there. And so I had the two of them, one of the Graf Zeppelin taken from that. And I don't know whether there's an amusing incident concerning me directly, but is it worth digressing? Yes, as I mentioned, a lot of these cadets on the ship were German, a few Swedish, because all the continental ones, they had to sail, if they wanted to become officers in their merchant marine, they had to sail on square riggers before they could get their apply for even the training school. So that and this fellow was his mother was a countess. I suppose that makes him a count or something like that. This young fellow, I suppose about 16, she gave him a pile of money and says apparently they were very wealthy and so on. So he gave him this money, and he set off for to get a ship to the Åland Islands, where he was going to sign on. It was already arranged with Eckner that he'd be taking a job, and I guess it was summertime then. But when he got to Hamburg, St. Pauli there, the red light district, this fellow went and blew all his money on the girls in the red light district. And all this money that his doting mother had said for everything that he needed sea boots and sweaters and everything else that he needed. Well, I think he had sweaters and so on, but certainly sea boots, sou'westers and so on was missing, so that, that shouldn't worry him. He got on the ship and then sailed around South Africa to Australia, and again the passage was there. I think it was more or less summertime or springtime or something, that so he didn't miss it, that he had some heavy boots, but he hadn't got any sea boots, knee-high sea boots and so on. And then they all were commiserating with this fellow. They said, well, now we're starting from Australia. You're going to be into big trouble now, because you won't have... It's not going to be like it has been. It's going to be cold. Of course, even they couldn't visualize how cold it was going to be. But you need... And they said, well, what we suggest you do, you go into the sail locker one night, keep in, and find some old scraps of sailcloth, find some fairly stiff sailcloth, and then cut a piece out of it, and then you can tar it very thoroughly. It was several coatings of tar, and then sew it up, and sew those onto your heavy wooden, boots there. And that's what he did when we were south of Kangaroo Island. One night he went in, and he came out with a nice lump of cloth, which he cut in.